Hi everyone, welcome to the Reputation Made Easy podcast. Today I'm joined by Kane and Paul Holland. Hi both, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm very well, thank you.
Good.
It was a very good session today, wasn't it? What are your thoughts about it, Kane?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I always really enjoy having a guest on. I think it always gives us an extra bit of insight, and it was obviously, of course, great to have Paul here from Beyond Encryption to give us some of that keen insight that sometimes maybe me and you are missing as external consultants. So It was really valuable. I think to me, I always like to talk about the supply chain and sort of the broader implications on third parties and vendors. So I think it was a really keen one for me, and I really enjoyed this session. What about you, Paul?
Yeah, really good. Really interesting. I mean, lots of, as you quite rightly pointed out, Kate, there's dilemmas, aren't there, in terms of the conflicted legislation. And I have a suspicion your customers and the people that are attending your podcast, they're already a step up the ladder from a lot of other people by actually, you know, seeking some help or understanding some of these issues, being blunt. I mean, that's when you've got a problem or a risk or something, you've got to go somewhere to start that dialogue to understand what you've got to do. So the very fact that so many people attended again is a testament to what you guys are doing. So it's really cool.
You're absolutely right. I think it was a very nice session. It's important to always make this distinction, isn't it? Because Online Safety Act now is out there and is literally on the news every single day. Unfortunately, not for the right reasons, but with a joint statement from the ICO and Ofcom, it was really nice to see as well some approach between both entities, and obviously approach this dilemma not with obviously two experts that you are on different sides of the thing. So it was really, really nice. But I will leave our audience to make their thoughts about it as well. And I hope you'll enjoy the session. Thank you very much.
Enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Before we get into introducing the session, again, I'll just do a few pieces of housekeeping. Miles, at some point at his convenience, will bob the... he's holding his hands up. Apparently, maybe he's not. We will bob the privacy notice in the chat later on in the session, just letting you know that these sessions are recorded, of course, as you can see in the Teams meeting. So if you want to reach out to us and exercise any rights in that regard, please feel free to do so. Of course, again, as well with the AI chatbots, if possible, if you can decommission those prior to the session. If not, again, we'll be going through and removing those as soon as we can. So just hang tight in that regard. I think that's all I wanted to cover. But we've got a very exciting session today. We are having a look at the Online Safety Act through a data protection lens, and then what this means for organizations navigating that. So we are very fortunate today to be joined by Paul Holland, who's the CEO and founder of Beyond Encryption. Happy Friday, Paul. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too, and thank you for the invitation to participate.
Absolutely. Do you want to give yourself a brief little intro for the folks listening?
Oh, wow. Okay. Happy to do that. Yeah. So, I'm Paul. As you mentioned there, founder of Beyond Encryption. As a business, we're quite heavily involved in security and some of the things that corporates have to do in order to help comply with the regulatory obligations that we're all placed under these days. And that can sometimes be a bit of a challenge, but we work with all sorts of larger and small businesses, right across the range from one-man bands right through to the likes of the Avivas and HSBCs and other businesses. But I'm sure more of that will come out when we're chatting about some of these challenges. I suspect the Act and the stuff you guys are doing practically is of more interest to your audience.
And I think... I'm kind of going to segue to you in fairness, Kate. And I think one of the keys for us as we get started in looking at this session with you, Paul, and the listeners is first kind of discussing what the Online Safety Act is. And I suppose the reason for this is, as Kate is about to wonderfully allude to, is that we feel like maybe there's an element of maybe misunderstanding in relation to the framework of the law. Kate, I don't know if you want to take the reins on that.
Yeah, I mean, this question, not only about the podcast topic itself, but as well, because we're navigating a little bit on LinkedIn and other social media platforms. And I came across someone saying that the Online Safety Act is actually part of the data protection framework. So I think actually it's important to explain a little bit what the Online Safety Act actually is and means for the organizations and obviously for the world itself, and to make the differentiation between the UK data protection law and in this case the UK GDPR. So I would like to say that the Online Safety Act, as the exactly the word the name says, is a safety regime. It places duties in obviously in certain online services and to identify, assess and mitigate some harm that will potentially include any illegal content, any fraud, and any risks to the children, as you all know. Very, very nice topic to myself. And on the other end, we have the UK GDPR, even the data protection law in any way, that is about how we, or I mean the data controllers and the organizations handle personal data, whereas the Online Safety Act is more about actually what is happening in your platform of services and what you are expected to do about it. So there is a massive challenge, and I think probably Ken and Paula will now pick your brains on that, because actually me and Mark in a podcast a couple of weeks ago, we discussed a little bit about the dilemma that I think is clear about data protection law and in this case UK GDPR and obviously the Online Safety Act. Because in our view, the Online Safety Act is a little bit more about monitoring, whereas like the protection, et cetera, which means potentially a collection of additional information, of additional personal data. Whereas then we have the UK GDPR that says, hold on, we cannot over-collect personal data because we have something called the principle of data minimization, and any other, obviously, the connection of other principles. So the things is very clear to me a potential dilemma between both. And so I think my question would be, how actually in today's world, how actually can be this balance between both? And in your thoughts and even your, Paul, in your situation, in your experience with Beyond Encryption, actually, how do you measure? And if it was a challenge that actually came up in your world?
Yeah, most definitely. And I think we are going to fiercely agree. But the Online Safety Act, and I'm pretty sure all of your listeners and your customers and colleagues would agree that the principles of it about trying to ensure that there's no harm are valid, and I can't see that anybody would possibly argue against that. Mm-hmm. I guess where the dilemma really starts to lift itself is with the fact that at the same time we're all required to respect privacy, which we as individuals want to see the people we deal with respect on our behalves, and therein lies the challenge between the two sort of conflicted positions, and the grey area between is something I'm certain we probably have all seen lift itself through the Apple debate with the government when they were sort of talking about encryption keys and what they should and shouldn't be able to access. So it's become a very public, well rehearsed, well trod line, really. But currently there's no way, unfortunately, to scan encrypted messages without weakening the underlying encryption. So we all enjoy certain technologies when we're on the internet, and you'll see a little padlock appear when you're browsing onto certain sites that are affording you some security, which is fabulous. We all want that, given the risks that there are out there. And even quantum, before that question comes up, if someone asks it, even quantum computing, when it comes through, mathematically, quantum computing enables you to try and attack those sorts of encrypted links through what they call brute force. But that's purely because they can try a lot harder, a lot quicker. But even with that, you're talking about hundreds of years to pop open an AES 256 piece of data. That's an algorithm. That's a method, a mathematical method used to sort of safeguard our data. Mm-hmm. But you either preserve encryption or you introduce systemic access points. The ability for someone to, I'm afraid, put your privacy to one side and access the information you're trying to protect from others. So I think that's the dilemma that I suspect possibly was the foundation of why
your session today was to trying to think about some of the problems that exist when you're trying to play both of keep in tune with both of those topics.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I suppose it's a fine line with trying to comply with both elements of the requirements, isn't it? As Kate was mentioning, when we strip it back from obviously the data protection perspective, as we so often want to do, especially from our side, obviously we look at probably more on the ethical and the principle of processing that what is necessary. Excess data, really, it's additional data that garners more harm, especially when we're considering the nature of the people who are going to be accessing things that the Online Safety Act are designed to protect. So it's looking at the nature and the context of that data and trying to protect that whilst also complying with the Online Safety Act and making sure that everything is accurate and minimized, and that we've also managed to comply with the rest of the principles is really no easy task. And by the sounds of it, it seems like to some degree organizations are struggling with it in the predominant public domain. I mean, we've seen in the news recently, and I feel like often within the podcast, we're talking about things like obviously Reddit very recently being sort of the big one in terms of where Ofcom was sort of directing their sort of regulatory scrutiny. Which is good to see, and I'm really happy that it's something that that's happening, and that the ICO are kind of piggybacking on it in some respect as well, with the 4chan stuff as well. So it seems like something that maybe people are struggling to come to terms with potentially, or to feel prepared in essence for some of these requirements. Why do you think something like that may be, Paul? Why do you think there's a particular reason that potentially some elements are being neglected slightly?
Well, I think unfortunately, and I hope there'll be lots of virtual nods, but the reason I guess you guys are successful is because, you know, this is a changing feast, isn't it? You know, there's a lot to think about, and it doesn't matter what problem you try and broach, you know, unless you're on it all the time, you know, there's a lot of movement around what you are obliged to do, and those tensions between the different legislations. You know, I know again, and forgive me if I don't put this in the right way, but you know, this whole thing about subject access reports, I mean, that's the processes that without systems like yours that people have to go through in order to try and comply with something that is an entitlement on behalf of their customers, you know. So, you know, again, there's some tensions there, aren't there? The need to ensure that you conform with a provision of data when it's requested, and the problems that come alongside that, which I'm sure are numerous, and you can tell me much more about that than I know. But at the same time, satisfying those SARs in a way that is also mindful towards the security of the data and making sure it lands in the right hands. So, you know, there are all these tensions permanently we're wrestling with, aren't we, all the time. So I can see someone saying a sudden eye twitch.
Sean, it normally loves a good SAR, doesn't he, Sean?
it's a common pain point for our listeners, the old SARs.
But there's an entitlement that people are unfortunately required to address, and yet the problems that are just inherently connected with satisfying a SAR, and therefore, you know, we're already into that wrestling match, and you know, at the first gay, as it was. So I think it doesn't feel like life's going to become any easier, unfortunately. It's the practicalities and the things that you can do that mean that you're safeguarding your business, and not just from ICO and GDPR fines and all those huge numbers that, you know, get thrown around and banded around in editorial coverage, but because, you know, if your customers fail to see the fact you're respecting their data privacy, that's not a great place to start from at a business value level. So it can be really, really, really impactful if you don't do the right thing. So it's a hard one. I guess none of us have got a silver bullet, but hopefully a few steps towards that.
I think in general, you know, some organizations that we are working with and some examples that we have been seen as well and shared with us in terms of challenges is exactly what you're mentioning, Paul, is the fact that we have such a massive difference of legislation to be applicable at the same time to exactly the same examples. But then we need to address as well budgets. We need to address as well human resources and who is actually able to deliver certain work and data protection, and then the safety side of it, and then security, etc. Because automatically, at least I came across at least five different roles and five different people. So this means that these people need to be trained, they need to be aware of actually what's going on and if they are able to actually deliver this. So I think as well, one thing that comes to my mind is to understand exactly what should be able to kind of address all these things altogether. Mm. So first things come across is potentially governance side of it. So the policies, the procedures, responsibilities, who does what, in what sense and what in what terms. At the same time, we have the other side, that is how we're going to implement this. So the technology side of it, where you come obviously on the security side with encryption being obviously one of the examples of those. My always question is, what should we do first? Should be the policy, should be implemented, but then it comes, I don't know, it seems to me, if we do implement the policies before, it does not actually change anything. But then if the technology comes first, probably is a little chaotic because there is no governance on the side. So probably I would say a data mapping and understanding exactly the risks that are actually involved and with the data protection impact assessment, etc., coming first. And then probably address the high level kind of risk activities. But I would like to understand your thoughts as well on this, because thinking about services, actually, well, the UK GDPR and this Online Safety Act actually apply to both frameworks to the same organization. How actually would you think, Cain, for example, what would be your approach?
It is a layered question, isn't it? And and you're right in sort of presenting that trying to comply with all these different mm-hmm. requirements at a given time is difficult. However, I would say the UK GDPR already kind of, at some degree, covers that we need to take a data protection by design default approach, mm-hmm. which also includes to obviously harmful content online and content likely to be accessed by children. So we've kind of got a wing of that ticked off, I suppose, that they kind of complement one another. Of course, that then leads to the requirements potentially of the then collection of the further data to verify that age. That's when things get a bit nuanced. But I suppose in terms of resourcing and strategy, I think it's collectively got to be something that the business works on in some kind of tiered kind of format. So once we agree on, you know, in effect, that we need to get X measure in place, we need to get this security measure in place in order to verify an identity, then it's got to work all the way down. So I think you're right. I don't think you necessarily just start with the provision of a system. It's never usually as quick as that anyway. You know, you got to make sure that you take in real keen diligence in understanding mm-hmm. what system best suits you. You know, specialist areas can be quite hard to find sometimes, especially the right one fit for a business. Some of them are built for massive corporations, mm-hmm. some of them for SMEs. You got to find the one that best fits you, you know, kind of like a Cinderella slipper kind of situation. So you've got to look at your appetite of risk for a business and trickle it down that way. So we know that we want to use X system. We'll take diligence in doing so, and we've got to map out realistically who's going to be responsible for what. So yes, we need to look at the system. In the background, we need to be making the policy and procedure. We need to have the facilities prepared to train the staff who this is going to be relevant to, and then start to look on the external. You know, the external is going to matter just as much as the internal. This is going to affect our customers, potentially in some kind of significant way. So how are we informing them that we're doing so? Do we need to do any sort of communication campaign with anybody on the website? Maybe we go straight out to customers. Mm-hmm. How do we roll it out? And it's really difficult in any kind of system provision, I'm sure anybody will tell you, or in any kind of excess data collection or anything new. It's always, or would typically require, a lot of steps. It's not as easy as, okay, we want to do it, let's crack on. You know, we've got to jump about 30 hurdles before we even really get to the point of putting a system in place or putting a process in mm-hmm. place. So it's super layered and it's very difficult, especially when you're juggling multiple pieces of legislation at a time, usually.
Do you have any thoughts, Paul?
Definitely. But I mean, probably more of the same from yours. I agree with everything you said there, Kate. I mean, for me, and you used these words at the beginning, Kate, was, you know, you need to understand what it is you're trying to de-risk. So, you know, where is your data? You know, where are your exposures? You know, those, that's the, you know, the, your plan, really, you know, just reiterating, and those will cascade into, therefore, where are your risks? And it's only really at that point you can start. And again, I know you guys provide, and the training thing for me always feels like an absolute, you know, that's got to be a starter point for everything, isn't it? You know, because people understanding the problems, first of all, can then help contribute to, well, you know, so where, what do we need to fix? You know, again, responsibilities and things come into that. And only at that point, I guess, can you say, well, so therefore, what tech is there that can help? I think one of the pieces that we've become cognizant of, and probably the very reason we exist, I mean, we decided some time ago to pick a fight with some of the biggest, you know, tech suppliers in the world. Not to try and displace everything they do, because to be blunt, that would be impossible, but to become very, very proficient at one area of what they do. And in some of those providers are now actually recommending us. But the point was, you know, there's no point in putting a piece of tech in place if it's going to create a counter effect, which is really damaging. So, you know, one of the reason, as I say, we picked on this topic so many years ago was because the systems there, yeah, they could solve a problem, but what they did was they put this great big barrier between you and your customer, because they made it very difficult to communicate with them. Well, that feels like you solved one problem and replaced it with another one.
So
I think you've got to be sort of practical about that stuff, and we've definitely had a mind towards that all the time. You know, this needs to be super easy but super secure, unfortunately, and those two things sometimes are conflicted too. You can't start to take your remedial actions until you understand the problem you're dealing with. So I think the point you made at the beginning, a plan, really, you know, that word is a great place to start. And then try and pick out the solutions that are going to give you the biggest bang for buck, to use those phrases.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fantastic point, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, the point you make in relation to, I suppose, the potential impact sort of broader than the security implications, then potentially then making that barrier in between you and your customer bases is I think such a key point, actually, that is probably potentially overlooked. I think it's probably really easy to look at all these solutions and these systems and go, on paper, operationally, absolutely fantastic. Yeah. You know, they'll do a job and then some. But what then in terms of the customer journey? I mean, this is key, I suppose, more for me and Kate sometimes in terms of the roles that we do at DPP, I suppose, in broader top management, I guess, in that respect. But we're always looking at the customer journey and how what we are doing is actively affecting that. And sometimes, just because a system or a process would work great on paper for the staff and for the board and for managers, great, but how does it actually impact the people that are trying to access this service? And what are the implications of that? Because I know that I suppose the purpose of the online safety is to prevent that harmful content, but still make the elements of the content that is necessary to access easy to do so. Obviously, we want to put barriers in the places that we don't want people at.
Yeah.
How do we make sure that doesn't affect the other elements of it also?
And sadly, we live in a world, don't we, where, I mean, marketing plays such a big play. You know, how often have you bought something? And I'm not even saying software, you know, and I really believe and hope we don't fall into this, but which doesn't quite live up to the dream. Yeah. So everyone's going to put their best pitch forward, aren't they, in terms of what, you know, best foot forward, should I say, about what, you know, they're trying to sell you. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, it's never quite the rosy picture that they might paint. So again, you need to try these things. You know, it's the reason we try and make sure people play around with the system before they start committing, because you know, you're better to understand what it is that you're buying and make sure that you're getting value for money out of what you're buying. You know, so
definitely, it's like visiting a house, isn't it? I mean, if you want to buy a house, you know, estate agents have a knack at making these places look absolutely excellent, don't they? And then you go there.
They're good at photography.
There's half a roof. You know, and yeah, exactly. I can't forget my spirit. That's what I do. I go around, I check everything. There's a good foundation there. But I think that's key. And I think that's a big part of, I suppose, supplier engagement, isn't it? And having trust in your third parties and third parties kind of giving you the tools so you can place that trust in them, because you don't, obviously blind trust is never really an ideal thing is it? But obviously, third parties are likely to play quite a big part in some of the online safety acts and the GDPRs always roll out. So it's going to have quite a big implication on those. And I suppose the onus is on the controller to keep a clean house.
Yeah, I was about to say, I mean, I think the key point as well is definitely client expectations. And they now currently are expecting to every single online service or anything that is actually being distributed as a service actually is safe. And everything that is promised in false words on the marketing side of it actually is true. And we forget sometimes that all of this can be very pretty on the outside world, but actually when you try to go a little bit deeper, it's actually, in other words, actually, we've seen this every day, don't we, in our work. Some due diligence that sometimes we need to carry out on suppliers, when we go to their websites, it looks fantastic. Mm. But actually, when you go deeper and ask for the policies and try to cross-reference, then let me see then what you have to see if it corresponds to the policy actually is not true or actually is inaccurate. So it's a very important side of things to actually be critical and challenging what you see and what you have. But I obviously on our side, we're professionals. So actually we do this for work. The problem on the client side, and I do always like to as well to see the other side of things, is how do they have actually the tools to do that? And thankfully, they do. They have the rights. They have majority of rights within the UK GDPR and as well on the consumers side of things as well and the Online Safety Act as well. So they do have several rights. So now the thing that I think we need to embrace and improve is the educational side of things. So making sure that they are aware of their rights, making sure that they know exactly what they can do, what cannot do, what to expect or not to expect, and actually what can they request from the suppliers and these organizations. Normally the barrier is the organization saying this is an internal documentation, internal policy. So aside from your privacy notice, you don't have access to anything else. So actually, you need to trust us, and that's everything that we can say to you. But I do believe that when organizations, particularly, then they have this so important role to play in our lives as consumers as well and clients, they should be able to provide with as much information as possible, even if not the document itself. And if they don't do it, I normally see it as a red flag. So I try to put that in my personal life as well.
I was going to say one other thing, sorry, which is, you know, I think it's, we have to remain, as you do, I'm sure, cognizant of the fact that everything we're talking about here is, you know, these are legal obligations and almost faced with these problems. For most people, you know, they've still got to get on with business as usual.
Exactly.
You know, so what they really want to do is be able to put that to one side and know that it's being dealt with, because actually, you know, just dealing with business as usual is enough, let alone them to think about all the other things. So again, I think this just plays into the very point you've made. It's just trying to lay out those systems and processes and sources and training, sources of training and expertise that help, you know, navigate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And is there anything that you feel that people or people sort of within our space as like DPOs who will actively mm-hmm. sort of be looking out for these kind of systems that can potentially help them if they fall within the scope of the Online Safety Act? Is there anything that they should be particularly careful about when engaging with any of these vendors? Is there any kind of like, I don't know, elements of sort of traps that people may fall into, with aside from, I suppose, the marketing element of it?
Yeah. So difficult to pinpoint traps in terms of what they should look out for. I mean, if I tell you what we've done to try and allay some of those fears, that's probably the best way I can answer that question, which is, you know,
yeah, please.
Is for us certification. Has been a big and important one, you know, the Cyber Essentials Plus, and then ISO 27001 and all those sorts of things. We, you know, we're obliged to do that stuff when you're dealing with, you know, large enterprises, but there is equally important, you know, to demonstrate that you're doing things in the right business fashion, really, in my opinion. Yeah, we're right down to, for us, we've gone as far as becoming B Corp certified, because that's not just about trying to save the planet. It's about being ethical and being a business that, you know, walks the walk, just doesn't say these things on great podcasts, because, you know, obviously that's great. The other one I think is a great barometer personally, and I think it's worth looking at if you're looking at suppliers, is support, actually. I think I've always found support lines as a really interesting barometer. You know, I personally, and this is just a personal opinion, I can't stand being put onto call waiting lines and people not returning my call or not having a human being available to talk to you. That just turns me off immediately. Now, I appreciate, you know, for some of the systems, that's a lot more difficult to provide at the scales that some of these organizations are operating at. But in truth, you know, decent support from someone you can get hold of and ask a question of tends to me to be a bit of a barometer of whether that company really cares about you being a customer at all in the first place. So it's what I do personally, you know, and also that, you know, the community thing, you know, feedback, speaking to other people. Have you dealt with this supplier? What's been your experience? Now, they're lucky, you know, the people on your podcast have got a great community here of outreach via you that they can sort of test the water with. And I think that particularly when you're looking at subjects like this, which are so specialized, I think that's a great place to start, because it isn't easy, is it? It isn't easy, you know, with marketing and Instagram, and everyone can make themselves look, you know, amazing. How do you get to what really is going on? You know,
I suppose there is a real value in that, the community aspect of it, and obviously that's why we're so grateful for obviously you guys as the listeners and the viewers and the people that obviously join live, because, you know, we hope that that's the further benefit of these things as well, where you can sort of talk about these pain points. And as much as maybe for some of our more routine sectors and more routine customers, they won't be obviously too considerate of the online safety apps in relation to the realms of what's going to apply to them. But there's still always such a nice tie-in. And I think there's an evident tie-in in relation to security, obviously the confidentiality principle and security principle. And then just looking at sort of broader vendor management, I think all these things are still really applicable to the broader data protection consideration, irrespective of whether you feel like you fall under the scope of that or not.
And I think this AI, and just making a point that Charlotte is making, I think it's so when you are talking about clients and the client's expectation and the client journey, anything related to client, I'm sure that there is the efficiency side of things that I appreciate, that we are so busy and sometimes things are just quicker. But then, do you actually want to speak with AI then to just not answer your questions? Or actually you have three options and just to press the numbers and none of them are actually the ones you wanted? But completely like side of things, I think, and this goes along with recent news actually on Meta, Instagram side of things, and now with TikTok actually, where TikTok refused to use encryption as a method of for the messaging things, because they said and in a very summarized way that the fact that they were in encryption, they will not be able to identify any harmful content and illegal messaging, so they decided not to proceed with that. The same goes with Instagram, so actually they were using it and then they just completely like neglected anyway and to cancel the usage of the encryption exactly for the same motive. So my question, I think, is bearing these examples in mind, and obviously we are talking about two very much big organizations in our world and with such a massive influence and impact in all of us, particularly on children's side of things. What are your thoughts about this in terms of even encryption as security?
Listen, the subject really close to my heart, you know, I mean,
yeah.
Because the opposite side of the coin are people, you know, in the UK, like Telegram and others, who say, well, if you force us to put a backdoor into what is basically a service to enable people to exchange information without fear of someone reading it, we'd have to withdraw from the UK. And Apple have said the same sort of thing, really. So, you know, for us, this is a real dilemma because, you know, fundamentally, when we architected what we've created in the Maloc solution, it is with that in mind. You know, when when those of the listeners on your podcast today are communicating with their pension provider or their bank or their investment provider or the health provider, those companies are legally bound on those topics to employ encryption to ensure that there's no interception of that data. And they're also legally bound under ICO obligations to provide a layer that addresses one of the biggest areas, which is misdirection. Yeah. So mm-hmm. The ICO reports quarterly that they publish around data leaking and incidents, it's about sending the wrong thing to the wrong person. Now, that is quite problematic if you can't employ encryption, because it's simply not possible to fulfill the ICO obligations. And then we're back to the same dilemma. I mean, we cannot read what people send on our system. And we've done that deliberately, because otherwise we can't literally operate in the manner I've just described. Our users don't want us to be able to read their data. And to be frank, I don't want to be able to read their data either. Mm-hmm. What I need to know is once they are in correspondence with the right gate, that at that point you and they can read that information, but not us. So it's a really hard one, and this is really full circle back to that original debate, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Yes, of course. We track suspicious activity. We're very careful when people register to try and ensure that they're real, and that they aren't using the system for something which is not what it was intended and would be captured under the Online Act. But the Online Act simply doesn't allow for you to filter the content of something that's been encrypted in order to even examine it and filter or ascertain whether it is misuse. We do everything we can around that, but fundamentally, we're trying to help two parties secure their correspondence and exercise their right to privacy. So it's a real dilemma.
It is. And I think it's quite a tricky one, because in one hand you have the literal privacy between the users, and then exactly what the reason, potentially one of the reasons that they're actually using those sort of channels and their social media or websites or platforms, etc. But then on the other side is the protection kind of side of things, isn't it? And to be honest, one of the news that I normally see, to be honest, regularly, is always around Telegram. So Telegram is always involved in all these scandals about all these. Unfortunately, I'm laughing, but I shouldn't. But anything related to pornography, anything related to wars and terrorism, etc. And they come and say, well, this is our by default, our security measures, because in one end, actually, they are, well, working. But on the other side, we are not able, if you want something, we are not able to actually have the other, that is the protection in actually analyzing this. Mm-hmm. And there's a real, real dilemma. So actually, I think my question now is understanding, do you think, and both of you, and I'll punch the question both of you, do you think this will be actually a trend? So the fact that a scenario, the secure by default communication tools, etc., will become a standard, and then not only the Online Safety Act in one hand, but as well for the kind of data protection regimes, both together. So understanding, of course, that we have obviously Instagram and TikTok that we're talking about, etc., and we have on the data protection side, the privacy by design and by default. But just wondering if you do feel that the security by default automatically will become a standard within our organizations.
I mean, I suppose from my perspective, my answer is probably no. Just because I know the vein of what certain organizations are like, I suppose. I think maybe an outwardly facing, we take a data protection by design and security first kind of approach. But from what we're seeing in the news recently, there seems to be very glaring examples of people just kind of just taking skipping a jump away from where they need to be. And I think that's always going to be a trend. Obviously, sometimes margin profit to them is always probably going to be more important to data protection to some kind of businesses. That is the nature of these things. At the end of the day, your culture and your appetite to data protection and security and risk and all these things all depends on the buy-in from the business. And if the business doesn't have the buy-in, it's not going to work in the way that it wants to. Obviously, I would hope so. I would love if everybody took that approach.
Your world, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It just is unlikely to happen. And you can see it. Obviously, Reddit very clearly did not have an appropriate level basis. No DPIA. I think you mentioned a similar case to me today, didn't you, Kate? Where no DPIA was
something with four websites, one of them being Pornhub, the other one Snapchat, and two other that I don't recognize, but they were in the breach of the Digital Services Act, that is more or less the Online Safety Act, but applicable to European Union.
So yeah, it's just I think the answer is probably no for me, unfortunately. I think maybe people will start to move more towards at least an outwardly facing. We take this approach. There are always going to be bad dogs that exist. There are always going to be people who don't take it as seriously. But I think what is really positive to come from this, and I think will at least help change some perspective of organizations, is how on the ball I feel Ofcom have been as of recent in terms of their investigations and their fines, and the fact that the ICO is able to link it to data protection so consistently, which obviously they're going to continue to do because they think that makes them look great. As with the nature of everything, they tend to find something to hone in on, and at the moment that seems to be their focal point from at least what's covered in the news in terms of fines. Hopefully an improving picture, but a whole sort of resolution seems unlikely.
tend to agree with you, I think.
No really. Hopes, no.
Wouldn't it be nice if the world was a prettier picture? But yeah, and I think you mentioned another word a minute ago that in a way plays into another thing, appropriate. You know, so one of the things that we have discovered on our journey is, you know, these different methods are used, tend to be used for different purposes. So I suspect I'm one of the oldest in this audience on here, which is an irony. I'm talking about a subject like this, but the you know, when my youngsters were at college and university, there was emails not the thing, Dad. You know, it's instant messaging apps and what have you. And then the moment they joined university, the first thing you get given when you join university is a free Microsoft 365 email account. And from that moment forward, you understand why in 2026. We will see the first time that on a daily basis, the email traffic across the world will hit 400 billion communications on a day. So it doesn't matter what you look at and combine every other medium, but email, there are more words shared in email than are spoken on the planet on a daily basis. And it's increasing almost vertically, but it is, and there's a lot of spam and there's a lot of rubbish in there, but it is the medium by which most people tend to communicate around business-esque subjects, you know. And the other, the other strange one, maybe not strange, is that like mobile phone numbers, when you've got a mobile phone, you like to try and keep hold of that number to stay in contact. Well, the same can be said for your email address. It's statistically more likely you'll stay in contact with someone with their email address, believe it or not, than even their physical address. You know, people move home and don't tell their suppliers they move home, but they keep their email address. So I guess we are in a slightly different territory. Where you know, and yet, by the way, native email is open. It is like putting a postcard in the post box with your bank details. So hence the reason the ICO have laid that, you know, legislation, or you know, all those principles in play that they publish. So I think it's we're lucky in one context that perhaps the appropriateness and the nature of the medium and its purpose are different than maybe instant messaging apps, which are, I know, have been sort of used and abused and feature in different ways.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I suppose there's a lot more to be said around, I suppose, the security, and maybe there's a consistent reliability on organizations of using emails and not much else, in all honesty, in terms of even just normal business comms or comms outwardly face. I know you mentioned SARS earlier, didn't you, Paul? And I think that's a big thing for me, is trying to move people away from, you know, we take all this time to look after all this personal data when we redact it so meticulously. And then we send it by email in some cases. And that's a little bit scary to me. And whilst I appreciate sometimes, you know, people don't have the resources for much more expensive methods, there are always going to be ways, I suppose, to increase your sort of approach to security in relation to data. And I think a lot of that comes through the sharing and receiving of data predominantly more than anything. I think that's probably where we see the most gaps, I think, from our experience as a business in terms of a lack of security, isn't it, Kate?
Absolutely.
That tends to be where we see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it is always worth, and you always bear in mind, by the way, that, you know, there are instances where the current email infrastructure is secure using this thing called TLS. It's just that it's what they call opportunistic. It's not, you can't always guarantee it's on. And therefore, you know, it doesn't necessarily cover all the bases, which is why we exist. So, you know, again, it's horses for courses, and it's all part of that sort of learning journey, I guess.
I think the email sometimes is just is a weird one, isn't it? Because I was actually having this conversation yesterday with a customer of ours. We're doing just a data mapping and the rate of processing activities in Europa. And then there's always the question around security and measures, technical organizational measures implemented, etc. And the email was actually used, and Microsoft was used as a supply example. And then we have the organizational measures and technical measures implemented. And then we're talking about SaaS, so the conversation just developed a little bit. And then we realized and came to a point where every single person was saying that there was a multi-factor authentication allocated to their Microsoft accounts, as well as the password and credentials, etc., to access the email. However, the multi-factor authentication only worked once. So as soon as you are online and you are into the email address, that's it. There is no further security measures that will come from the email thing. Whereas actually that shouldn't be the case. It should be the case in the sense of, okay, you after a couple of hours or a couple of 30 minutes, 45 minutes of not using the mic, well, in this case, Outlook, potentially you should actually be able to just put again, as we have for other platforms and suppliers, it should be up the multi-factor authentication, and it did not happen. So this for me to say that actually there was linked to a breach, whereas she had made a login to the email address in the device, she shouldn't. But the instead of sign ups, the email address should stay there. So it was available to other people's devices, etc. And she was not aware of it because she thought the multi-factor authentication would be applicable. This for me to kind of conclude.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I saw it as well, by the way. Julie's note is really, really pertinent. You know, if you're communicating within an organization and you're all living and working on the same domain, same technological infrastructure, you probably don't need our system internally, by the way. You should. Yeah, and very quickly, we had to turn on this, what they call TLS security, transport layer security. And if not, you're using Teams, and Teams should be, again, giving you that point-to-point security, which is great. It's when you start to move into the domain of a third party that where email, unfortunately, will persist because they're not going to get onto your Teams infrastructure. But that's where you've got to sort of consider these other remedial actions and what have you. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think I'm just mindful of time. I'm close to wrapping things up. Plus, my laptop has died, so that's not particularly helpful. But I suppose, Paul, do you have any kind of closing thoughts for us in terms of why you think security in that vein is so important? Anything else you kind of like to bring up? And additionally, where they may be able to find you and the lovely folks at Beyond Encryption if they want to find out a little bit more about what you do?
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. And again, thank you for letting me participate in your session today. Really interesting. Closing thoughts for me, just a summary of what you said, you know, work with the right people that can help you understand the problem. Try and help your team understand the problem with training. Advocacy, you know, do the right thing by your customers. These are just normal business things. Look after their data, and I'm sure your customers will look after you back. And by all means, certainly, you know, we'd love, you know, our system is available if you're using it at a relatively low level. You don't have to pay to use it. So, you know, feel free to register. Just look up Beyond Encryption or Mail Lock. That's MAILOCK 1L for whatever reason we did that branding wise. And you can register and try the system out for free. Have a play around with it. But I have a suspicion that the data protection people are giving you the list of things that you need to follow, and it sounds like it's sound advice.
Yeah, we do try our best. But I think, Kate, unless there's anything else that you would like to
to close the session. Thank you so much, Paul, for joining us today. It was absolutely a pleasure. And thank you, Kate, again.
Thank you always, Kate.
Happy Friday, everyone. Yeah,
thank you to you.
Have a good weekend.
We will not see you next week as well. So please don't expect a session next week. We'll be away on bank holiday. Yeah.
So happy Easter, everyone.
Happy Easter. We'll catch you all on the next one.
Good day. Bye. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.